Major funding for the following edition of Soundings comes from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. Additional support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center, conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life. Welcome to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. Science, education, and the role of the United States in the global marketplace, this week and next on Soundings. You'll hear from Robert McCormick Adams, Secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, Eric Block, former Director of the National Science Foundation, D. Allen Bromley, Science Advisor to the President, Rita Colwell of the Maryland Biotechnology Institute, James G. Martin, Governor of North Carolina, and Congressman David Price of North Carolina's 4th District. I'll talk first this week with Robert McCormick Adams of the Smithsonian Institution. After that conversation, a discussion with Rita Colwell, Director of the Maryland Biotechnology Institute. Soundings on Science and Society will conclude this week with commentary from Congressman David Price. We begin then with Robert McCormick Adams of the Smithsonian Institution. Bob Adams, what about the notion of science and culture as we look around us in the real world and talk in terms of what the philosophers call the common good? How does the scientific enterprise connect with that social ideal?
Well, I don't think there are a lot of people in the real world today, and I say this with regret, who are giving a lot of thought to the common good. And I think that's the case in science, and I think it's the case in art, and I think it's the case in business, and I think it's the case in government. The range within which we are conscious and sensitive about what's out there narrows. We're all under intense pressures, and I don't think that scientists are, on the whole, more immune to those pressures than people in other walks of life. Mm-hmm. And I think there's really quite a lot of evidence that scientists are indeed driven by a sense of discovery and by a desire to understand problems, and mm-hmm. And those are certainly laudable motives, but the feeling on the part of anyone that they are responding to vast social problems doesn't take place very often. Mm-hmm. I would guess that if you talk to physicians and molecular biologists and so on working on the AIDS problem, that they must have a sense, because it's so immediately in their field of vision, that mm-hmm. they're dealing with a human crisis, and that may apply also in certain other limited areas, but most of us are trying to solve problems or overcome challenges or whatever that are really quite immediate, and all one has to do is to look at the kind of news that we see on the television, and you realize how little of it is really reflective of human need or human aspiration, how much of it is event-driven in a very mm-hmm. localized, episodic sense. And I think that's probably true of most of human life.
Does science drive the culture? Does culture drive the science? How do we figure out causality there?
It seems to me that we live in a world in which there are many little engines that are puffing away on their own in tracks that diverge and point in different directions, and science and technology may be one of them, But I don't think we can regard our society as a whole as being driven that way, and I think, in fact, you can make a better case that it works the other way around, the preoccupation of our society with a whole new set of external influences, let's say, with themes in music or sports or whatever that are circling the world at the speed of light doesn't arise from the fact that they circle the world at the speed of light, but from changes that have gone on within our own culture that make music cosmopolitan and that make entertainment something that is drawing upon world themes.
How does the ordinary citizen, who is ordinary in the best sense of the word, who is not a scientific expert, how does that individual get a sense that what's going on in science in this country, whether it's small research, big research, is a good thing? Do we have to take the word of the scientists and let it go at that?
I don't think you can expect in a democracy with limited resources and many needs, anyone to take anyone's word indefinitely. I think that's one of the things we're seeing, of course, is that challenging of credibility at every level of society. And I think it's a problem for science that the same can be expected of what they're doing. It's not clear to me how we overcome the problem on which you're putting your finger, because in a sense the demands of science itself are becoming more and more specialized. Here we get to the problem of the collapse of the American schooling system, because the language of science in good part is a language that includes a major component of mathematics, and the schooling system has not prepared people to deal with anything more than arithmetic. There is very little interaction between academics in universities who are training graduate students and college students, for that matter, and the people who are responsible for the design of the teaching programs that go into the schools. That's a very deep gulf, and I think that's been shown quite conclusively. There's a degree of disdain, in fact, on the part of academics for people who are going into teaching. Somehow the system is breaking down.
Rather than the intentions of the individuals.
Yeah, sure. And I don't see that breakdown of a system as something in which one can really say that science or technology is driving it, but rather that the harmonious composition of all of these elements into some larger, more effective whole is just not going on any longer.
Well, let's follow that line of thinking for a moment, Bob Adams. You are the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. How do we place ground our scientific enterprise in a democracy when we have a kind of leveling effect going on? People are entitled to know what goes on in the scientific enterprise, and yet science, by its very nature, exists as a kind of priesthood, a kind of a separate and an elite undertaking. Is that an irreconcilable tension? What do we do to bring them together?
Well, I think to some extent there will always be tension, and when I speak of desperately needed improvements in our primary and secondary education system, it's not with the idea that we're going to end the tension. The tension will always be there. The bulk of college students, for that matter, who take science courses are probably going to be taking the kind of course that is spoken of as physics for poets or something or other. In other words, an approach which is qualitative and not quantitative in most respects, and which
and yet substantial scientifically.
And yet, yeah. So that the problem is always going to be there. I wish we could say that there was more attention being paid by the media to effective science writing or science presentation. Of course, there are TV programs like NOVA and so on that are, I think, often very impressive. From what I've seen of the audience surveys, however, most of those programs are going to people who see all of them and who are devotees and who are already scientifically literate.
Preaching to the choir.
So that it isn't clear to me how we overcome this. The same is true if one looks at most of the science writing in newspapers. It's there, but of course some of it is a very indifferent quality, but even the people who are very good, I suspect, are writing for an educated elite rather than for great numbers of people. Mm-hmm. I don't have a simple answer to this.
Very quick footnote, Bob Adams, to our conversation, both as the secretary of the Smithsonian and as an individual science. Are you optimistic about the relationship between our science and our society?
I think there are tremendous people out there working. Tremendous. I mean, I'm continually impressed when I talk to young scientists by the not only the quality of mind but the quality of enthusiasm, by the sense of being on the threshold of great things. And whether we as a society are going to find the resources to keep them working is a tough question, and I have no simple answer, because resources are needed for many, many things. But the opportunity for extraordinary advance is there. I've attended a couple of meetings of a group that the National Academy of Sciences has brought together of young scientists speaking to one another, of some of the best of the young scientists, and the quality of electricity in the air as they talk about what they're doing suggests a time of which there's very little popular recognition, a time as exciting as it ever was in the history of science.
Robert McCormick Adams is secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to part one of Soundings on Science and Society, a series of conversations and commentary. Thanks to Radio Dialogue at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., for technical assistance in recording the preceding conversation with Robert McCormick Adams. Next on Soundings this week, a discussion with the director of the Maryland Biotechnology Institute. Rita Colwell reflects on American scientific education and the role of the United States in the global marketplace of the 21st century. Here is Rita Colwell.
Well, I think that the answer is that in some areas, indeed, we are producing illiterate children, but in other ways, they're extremely well-educated. For example, my children in high school were studying the DNA and the molecule of the heredity of life, and its mechanisms of transmitting information. Well, I didn't learn that until I was a graduate student.
I see. What about the fact that, following what you're saying here, Rita Colwell, that it looks like, okay, good, we have some kids who are doing well, but we're creating a polarized society, are we not? The real knows and the real know-nothings.
That's the danger. And in fact, that's the crux of the problem, because by the year 2000, 70% of the workforce, the entering workforce, will be minorities and women. Mm-hmm. And the kinds of training that's needed is increasingly technological. So we have this problem of the population, which is least represented amongst the scientifically literate, are moving into the majority of the workforce.
Now, you mentioned minorities and women. I take it that science, again, as an enterprise, aims to be gender blind. Tease that one out for me.
Well, as a matter of fact, recently I visited a wonderful institute in Japan, marvelous. Its expense laid out of probably $100 million, and they have 70 scientists. They very proudly pointed out to me that each scientist had a technician. The technician, in every case, was a woman, PhD. Now, on the way out, I said to the director, I said, this institute is incredible, but you've made one fundamental mistake.
What
he said,
that?
Oh, what was that? Well, you've assumed that genius is sex-linked. And the fact of the matter is that it is not. That is, those talented women who are left in a in a secondary technician position were in fact not allowed to express their creativity, to direct projects, to be the heads of projects, to be in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And that is as much of a loss of talent as it is to track children straight out of science.
Well, who should imitate whom? The Americans, the Japanese, vice versa, a middle ground, what?
If there was some way to merge the Japanese form of education with the American, I think we would find ourselves absolutely limitless in what could be done. That is, American children are taught to be creative, individualistic, to think. The Japanese student tends to be rotely trained and to accumulate a great deal of information, but to be quite rigidly structured in his or her schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there is some way to combine this ability to educate with a great deal of information and to train well in mathematics and mathematical procedures, simultaneously with thinking and understanding the material, that, I think, is the ideal.
Let's talk about that, Rita Colwell. What should American kids know? I mean, we have just a few minutes here. We can't go into great amounts of detail. But what is a sound scientific education?
It's an education that allows a student to question and to know where the answers can be found. That is, in being able to understand, to read, comprehend, to understand, and not necessarily be a mathematical genius, but to be able to understand, for example, percentages. If they had to understand, let's say, polls and the percentage of those who judge a position against another, to be able to understand what the statistical approaches that are involved. That's just one mm-hmm. example. But I think also we need to train our children, or educate our children, I should say, in fundamental knowledge of their environment, the knowledge of the life process, and I would say that it's critical for them to have not only a good scientific and technical training, but to have this woven into an understanding of the humanities. An appropriate statement, since we are in the Center for the Humanities.
I'm delighted to hear you talk that way, Rita Colwell. Let's talk about money. American education is principally a local enterprise. We have dozens, hundreds, thousands of school boards. Is it your sense that that the people who pay for American education are doing justice to these noble goals that you've been outlining here for our kids?
Well, we have an irony, a very sad irony, in that our best teachers are promoted into positions of management simply because it's the only way that they can
make a few bucks.
Have their salary increased.
Yeah.
This is a terrible loss because those who can teach well and who can be who can serve as a inspirational point for children then are lost to the teaching. As well, we have the problem of, in the past, of course, it wasn't an inequity of having women who were very intelligent being the source of our teachers. But now, in order to earn a reasonable salary, they are fleeing from the educational career to computer processing, etc.
Do you have any advice for us? Any again, we have to be relatively brief, Rita Colwell. Any notion of how to get, whether it's men or women, how to get these people back into the pipeline, educating our kids?
Well, it would help a lot if we would provide the respect to the profession and place it in a position where, by virtue of the salaries that they're paid and the position in society accorded them, we could make it clear that these are very valued people in our society, that the teacher, revered in China and other countries,
mm-hmm.
Should indeed be accorded that respect. Now, that's an idealistic statement again. Let us say that that interaction of parents and schools is very critical, and we've tended to lose that in the last few years. The last few decades, actually, there's been a tendency to leave it to the schools
That's
to
right.
do everything from
not only educate them but raise them practically.
Indeed, everything from social custom and behavior to sex education to training in professions.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. What about the interplay among and between the government, the professions, the scientific community, which you represent, and the world of business and commerce in this country?
Well, it's very, very interesting that all of those units of society have now recognized one very strong, very sharp, very critical economic problem. The economics simply are starkly stated that this workforce that I mentioned earlier, the year 2000, simply has got to be trained. And that means, for the economic reasons, the federal government, the Association of Universities, the industry, have begun to form partnerships to look at the problem of science and engineering education, the pipeline problem. I wish I could say they're doing it because of altruism, but whatever the reason...
To save themselves.
Of course. Yeah. But whatever the reason, yeah. It's a good thing that there is this partnership, this alliance developing, and this recognition at last. For example, the National Science Foundation budget for science and engineering education is well over $200 million now.
Mm-hmm.
It's the largest and fastest-growing component of the budget of the National Science Foundation.
Well, in practical terms, that sounds wonderful, but we live in a democracy with competing factions and interests. Somebody's going to lose out. Is that always going to be the case?
Well, you see, my advice to students who come to me and say, look, I'm going to major in computer programming because the jobs are there. My advice is, don't do that. Find out what it is you really are interested in and major in that, because that will carry you through the rest of your life. If you enjoy it, if you're good at it, there'll be a job for you.
Yeah, as I've heard it said, not only to my kids, but to other kids, find what you love, the money will follow. Is that naive?
No, that's good philosophy.
Rita Colwell directs the Maryland Biotechnology Institute. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the first segment in a two-part series of programs about science and American society. Here now is commentary from Congressman David Price of North Carolina's 4th District. From 1987 through 1990, David Price served on the Congressional Committee on Science, Space, and Technology.
When I was in high school in the 1950s, the shock of Sputnik spurred our nation to make large and rapid improvements in science and engineering education and to recruit thousands of young people into these fields. Today we face a challenge just as serious, perhaps more so. We face a challenge not only to our economic competitiveness, but also to our nation's historic preeminence in scientific education and research. Just as Sputnik shook us out of our complacency in the 1950s, today we must wake up to the fact that we're falling behind in education for tomorrow's high-tech economy. From the training of a new generation of scientists and engineers, to the development of technical training programs adequate to the changing workplace. National education, business, and government leaders agree that America's ability to compete in the global economy depends on a highly educated workforce. In my congressional district, which includes the cutting-edge technology of the Research Triangle Park, and several fine universities, business leaders tell me that education is their number one concern. Most new jobs being created today demand higher levels of scientific, mathematic, and technical skills than ever before. In fact, people with only a high school diploma qualify for a mere 15% of new jobs today, compared with 40% two decades ago. We must redefine our literacy problem in this country for the 1990s. The question is no longer whether Johnny can read and write, but whether he can comprehend a technical manual well enough to get a job at IBM. Although we've begun to focus on that problem, the state and federal response has not been good enough, as we found in a Congressional Sunbelt Caucus study on workplace literacy that I co-chaired 2 years ago. Our study recommended that the federal government play a catalytic role in developing higher quality and better funded adult education programs better focused on the needs of the workforce. The Sunbelt study also recommended developing and disseminating model programs, curricula, and teaching technologies, strengthening the relationship between adult basic education and the world of work, giving job training programs a stronger basic education component, and encouraging private sector support and enhanced public-private cooperation in the implementation of programs. I'm pleased to report that Congress is beginning to translate those recommendations into policy. We've finally begun to address our nation's shortfall in science education and in advanced technical training. In October, for example, Congress passed the Excellence in Math, Science, and Engineering Act, which includes provisions of my workplace literacy legislation. This bill establishes a grant program to expand the use of innovative technologies in the teaching of science and math. These grants will be used to develop curricula, computer software, or other promising technologies that can improve the effectiveness of basic math and science education. The bill also establishes math and science scholarships for undergraduates who agree to work as scientists, engineers, or teachers for a certain time after school. And it will improve our efforts to encourage participation in the sciences by minorities and women. While Congress has made real progress in improving workplace literacy, we still have an unfinished agenda. I'm hopeful we can move forward to improve technician training programs, helping employers train their workers, helping community colleges upgrade their technical, mathematical, and scientific programs. The challenge of science and math education and workplace literacy knows no regional or partisan boundaries, nor is it an area in which the federal government should necessarily play a dominant role. All of us, federal, state, and local government, schools, businesses, the media, all of us must work together. Together, we can better prepare our young people for the workplace of tomorrow. Together, we can maintain and improve this nation's economy. Together, we can improve America's position in the global economy. We simply can't afford to do otherwise.
Congressman David Price represents North Carolina's 4th District. From 1987 through 1990, David Price was a member of the Congressional Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the first segment in a two-part series of programs about science and American society. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 545. That's program number 545. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week, part two of Soundings on Science and American Society. You'll hear from Eric Block, former director of the National Science Foundation, from D. Allen Bromley, science advisor to President George Bush, and from James G. Martin, governor of the state of North Carolina. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. Additional support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.